it was this defining moment because the world had defined me, and it was how I defined myself and how cruel I became to myself.
Hello and welcome to the My Defining Moments podcast, where a sports star tells me the five moments that define their career. In 2006, the name Lindsay Jacob Ellis was all over the sports news after she fell whilst leading the inaugural snowboard cross event at the Winter Olympics. Fast forward 16 years, and at her fifth Olympic Games, the American finally stood on the top step of an Olympic podium, not once, but twice, with a gold also coming in the mixed event. With 6 world titles, 10 X Games gold medals, and 31 World Cup wins, she is the GOAT of border cross. And Lindsay is ready to tell me her 5 defining moments. Hi Lindsay, thank you so much for joining me on the My Defining Moments podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, thank you for having me. How is the weather over there right now?
It's grey. It's always grey in London.
It's fall and it's, just on the East Coast, so it's definitely going in and out and getting into that like fall weather, but I'm happy to be back in California for a hot minute before I start seeking the snow.
Yeah, so but before then, you've got a bit of a book tour to do. That's why you've been in New York the last few weeks. You've got your book it's out now, isn't it?
It is out now, yes. Last Tuesday, October 17th, was my publishing date, and there was definitely a big run-up. I mean, I've never been involved in the publishing world, in the literary world at all prior to this. I did write a kid's book, but I did not have a publisher, so I was basically like, oh, cool, I printed a book, and I'll sell it over social media. That's pretty much the extent, and that was just a fun little side project when we were all locked in our houses. So it just kind of made sense to, you know, kill some time and try a new endeavor when we couldn't go anywhere and I couldn't be around anyone.
But I guess this is kind of more of a autobiography telling your whole journey. I guess we'll probably cover a lot of those things in this chat today, but obviously more detailed in the book, I'm guessing, and it's a little bit more inspirational as well.
Yes, and the whole reason I wanted to share my story, for one, was to give my perspective and what I had to go through and how I had to find my inner strength and really reflect back on how I was seeing myself after the media had really painted me in a different light. So it was a lot of looking within and finding that next step that I needed to accomplish so I could give myself that kindness that I needed in order to be able to hopefully set myself up for the best possible success in 2022.
Yes, which obviously, as we do know, it worked.
It took 4 Olympic cycles to, you know, make that happen. And I share my ups and downs and, you know, the struggles that I was going through as that growth was happening, because as I was growing as an athlete, I was also trying to develop as an individual. And so many people don't realize a lot of times the athletes that get on the Olympic stage, especially their first time, are relatively young. And there's a lot of life experiences that they have not really been through. So really trying to be understanding of that. But the end of the bottom line with my book was about forgiveness, because I do title it Unforgiving. It was, you know, how my sport could be unforgiving, how I felt the media was unforgiving, but most importantly, how I was unforgiving to myself. So it shows what I had to do, my ups and downs, my injuries through those 16 years. And I hope this can inspire somebody to keep going for what they truly love, because you get knocked down, that's inevitable. You fail, that's inevitable. It's picking yourself back up and learning who to lean on to get that strength if needed, and find your pathway to success.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to reading it. It sounds like it's a very good book to get my hands on. So, but I guess in terms of your story, we'll go right back to the beginning. Born in 1985 in Connecticut, and when did sport kind of enter your life? Were you a sporty family? Did you try all kinds of different sports? How did it all start for you?
So my brother is 5 years older than me, so I was naturally following every sport that he was doing. And my parents always put us in every seasonal sport just because we had a lot of energy and it just seemed the best way to, you know, corral us and have some sort of organization. My brother was playing football. He was playing baseball. So I'm naturally playing those sports with him in the backyard. We lived kind of out in the middle of nowhere in Roxbury. It's this small little town and it's still pretty, you know, quaint and small and has that charm to it still to this day. But it was really far to, you know, see a friend. It wasn't really easy to just ride your bike to a friend's house. So unfortunately, my brother had to put up with playing with me when he was pretty young if we couldn't organize a play date with our friends. Naturally, I got into T-ball and Little League, and my dad and even my brother at sometimes would help coach. So they were very good at breaking things down. My brother always had a way to, you know, break something down in words, but then also be able to show me that was really relatable. And I still to this day process information in that same way. And it's probably just because I'm conditioned to it. But my brother exposed me to every sport he was interested in and more. He was the first person that got me riding on my bike without my training wheels, you know, not without that little forceful, like, you can do this. I'm not putting up, mom and dad aren't here to coddle you, so just do it. Otherwise, I was being left behind because there was always some fun activity. You know, my brother and his friends were making forts out in the woods or making cool, like, BMX trails. And if I wanted anything to do with that, I'd had to learn a way to just keep up and go with the flow. So that was definitely a crucial building block in my intensity, my drive to just not be left behind.
And then I guess, when did the winter sports kind of enter your life?
I would say pretty early on. Like, our families, we had two other families that were very close to us. My father had been best friends with Mark Shaw since high school, and then my dad's friend Bob Moore kind of joined the ranks shortly after, and they were just diehard passionate skiers. So they got my brother involved when he was pretty young, and then I was soon to follow. I didn't take to it right away because I didn't really like the cold all that much, and, you know, being cold and getting snow in my gloves at, you know, 5 years old. I was more so the hot chocolate hang out in the lodge kid for a while, but it was nice that my dad really didn't push me all that much to, you know, force that to happen. So naturally, when it was the right time, the conditions were good, that's when he decided to bring me out a second time to give it a go. And, you know, once I was then a part of the family, chasing my brother down and we're with the group, it became just part of our weekend ritual. And naturally, Mark Shaw and Bob Moore started having kids as well. So each kid kind of fell in line with having to go through those beginning steps and then wanting to be a part of the big group. So everyone had that driving force to keep up. We were always pushing each other. We were always supporting each other. And it was just our blended weekend family that we'd all go in and we'd stay at the one house together. You know, all the three dads went in on a house together. So it could make the ski season a little bit more affordable. From there, we were old enough to start getting season passes and be, you know, involved in the sport every weekend. And it was just like that badge of honor that, you know, you were old enough to hold a pass and that you were just a part of the mix.
And this kind of does bring us on to your first defining moment, which is your brother and doing your first kind of turns on the snow with him. Was this on a snowboard as well? Because obviously you mentioned you were doing skiing then. When did you officially switch to snowboarding, I guess, or did you straddle the two?
My brother was the pioneer for the family. Him and Bob Moore went out and tried snowboarding first, and my brother was hooked. He loved it right away. He just thought it was so cool. It was starting to you know, be seeing more individuals on the mountain were snowboarding, and we're like, this is cool. Like, you're on those chairlift rides for a long time. This is way before the detachable chairlift. So you're on this chair for a hot minute. So you're seeing, you know, all different styles of skiing, and now you're starting to see snowboards get in the mix coming down the hill. And my brother was always very intrigued, and he grew up skateboarding as well. So we were naturally drawn to it. And my dad was like, well, we shouldn't all try. Like, it could be very chaotic. So it was Bob and Ben that were like, oh, we'll be the pioneers. We'll try this. I got around eventually to take a lesson with my father. And I was about 9 or 10 years old. And my dad was actually picking it up really well. And he was starting to get the linking of the turns after the falling leaf. But I was having a lot of difficulty because I just didn't have the calf strength. And it was so different to skiing. And I just started to get my speed up with that. So I was too nervous to be really taking the time to break down, to really learn and have to go slow again. So I just ended up bombing the hill, doing the falling leaf, just staying on one edge and saying, hey, I can still keep up. I can still be doing this. But my brother eventually was like, no, we're not doing this. Like, we're going to the bunny hill. Everyone's in for lunch right now. They're pretty much done for the day. We're going to break this down. Since my brother was giving me that time and that patience to really break everything down, like he'd done with every sport, or giving me that support when I was trying to ride my bike without my training wheels. It really was just all that focus on that moment. And I knew he would not give up until the task was completed. So eventually that's what happened. I learned to link my turns, and it was like this big aha moment. And still to this day, like when I'm teaching people how to link their turns, it's always that challenging situation to go from that falling leaf, controlling that edge, and then once they do the J turn or start to link turns back to heel to toe, it's always like this click and it just happens. And that's exactly what happened when I was in that situation. So I can remember that feeling. And when I teach people, I am almost going back to that memory and know exactly how they feel when it comes together. It's like, oh my God, there it is. So that was a big memory and a defining moment for me, because then that gave me the ability to build speed and stay with the group.
And I guess, was that the point you kind of thought snowboarding was going to be more your thing?
It was still our family dynamic to be skiing in the morning and then switching over to snowboarding in the afternoon. Because once the whole family kind of started to get into it, and the Shaws and the Moores, then it was this new way to share the mountain. We'd always been on Stratton and skiing, so you knew the mountain like the back of your hand. You knew how you were turning down every trail. And the cool thing is, when you get on a snowboard, that terrain changes because your weight is distributed differently on a snowboard. So it's almost even fun when I go back to Stratton to now put on skis, because I've been on that mountain so much on a snowboard now that almost makes it a new mountain again and makes it really exciting to explore my line down the mountain now on skis again.
Cool. Moving on to your second defining moment, because it was around that time, wasn't it? You had a big house fire, and I believe this kind of really did kind of solidify which of the two you were going to do.
This was a very upsetting moment in the book for my family. And it brought all three families together, because we had been, you know, building our ski lives and our, you know, weekend warrior lives up at Stratton for almost 10 years. And we had so many things that we lost that we couldn't get back. And most of it was all of our family photos and pictures of us on the mountain. You know, this was way before everyone has an iPhone that everything just goes to the cloud and nothing is lost. Everything's all backed up. So once these photos were lost, it was nearly impossible to get them all back. We got the phone call that the house burnt down just after the new year. I believe it was 1998. But we were really lucky that nobody was in the house. We decided, you know, we finished out the Christmas holiday season. I believe work was going to be starting back up for my dad, and school was going to come back on. So we decided, you know, we're going to beat the holiday traffic and just go home now. We, you know, we kind of got enough of the holiday crowd, and we were just heading back home. So my mom and I left early, but my dad and my brother almost stayed over that night, but they decided to leave and come back. So it could have been a horrible human tragedy if they did stay. So at least no one was in the house. We did just lose things, but unfortunately some memories. The wonderful thing that the whole Stratton Mountain community came together to help us get back on our feet. The Stratton Mountain photographers that would stand at the top of a run or halfway down, that, you know, we do our family photos year after year, they'd be our Christmas cards, had almost 10 years of backstock of these photos that we had ordered from them. So we were able to replace a lot of the photos. Some of my early skiing photos, however, we were not able to get back. But after that moment, you know, we're dealing with insurance. We're trying to figure out how we financially, you know, get back some of our stuff without, you know, making it prohibitively expensive to try to get everything. It's like you think of socks, long underwear, jackets, pants, like you're coming to all of those costs all at once instead of slowly over time. It was just going to be a lot for my parents to cover. So my dad asked us right then and there, you know, we can only afford one sport right now. Do you want skis or snowboard? And my brother and I jumped on that opportunity and said we wanted snowboards. So at that time, it was so upsetting to have to make that choice and to deal with that loss as a family. You can't always see right then and there, why did that happen? What was the reasoning for that? And I'm a pure believer that everything happens for a reason. You might not see it in the moment, but looking back, I often wonder, would I still be dabbling at both? Would I pick at one? But I also did enter a race that following weekend after some of the local shops helped us get, you know, discounts on clothing and a snowboard. And I ended up winning that race, which got me an invitation to the USASA Nationals in Telluride. So it caught the eye of the coaches at Stratton Mountain School and had an opportunity to see where I kind of fit in the national ranking for snowboarders in my age division.
And yeah, I guess it is such a defining moment because you had to make that choice then, even though you didn't know at the time that it was going to be a choice that would kind of affect the trajectory of your life in a way. That snowboarding then did become your life, and like you say, you got the opportunity to show what you could do at that age. But and then I guess going forward with your snowboarding, did you try, or you tried all the events like half pipe, slopestyle, were they all kind of, was it just, when did you find border cross, I guess, when did that enter your life?
So border cross was the event I was first involved in, and we kind of fell into that, you know, after I started getting, you know, decent at snowboarding, and it was just this like little weekend or a Friday night race that was happening, and we really liked it just because, you know, we were told about the community, oh, they're doing these like fun little races on Friday night, and it would be the local schools that would come up, it would be some of the parents competing, and it was on the bunny slope. It was something that the park crew just threw together in a couple hours, so it wasn't anything elaborate, just bank turns, some rollers, maybe like a couple little jumps, and then they'd plow it after immediately, and that was the bunny hill for Saturday morning. But it just established the tempo and gave you the opportunity to be in the start gate and you're racing in heats. And then once I started getting involved with SMS, did we start, you know, getting racing GS and slalom because there was the opportunity for nationals, you know, and then it was really right after that fire that it's like, okay, like this is kind of the direction that I chose to go. And, you know, this is now snowboarding is taking center stage and skiing's kind of, we'll get to it back eventually, but never really did until like my probably early 20s did I ever get skis back on my feet. After being, you know, involved in half pipe and slopestyle later in the seasons when the snow would be more consistent and the temperatures would be colder than Stratton would build up their half pipe. So it wouldn't be till later in those February and March that we'd be able to dabble in that. And so that would also reflect on the, you know, local competitions that we were doing. But it was probably a few years until I kind of brought that into my routine with Stratton Mountain School. Right in the beginning, it was just border cross and then GS and slalom. Kind of just stuck with those for a couple of years. And then naturally, my coaches at Stratton Mountain School said, we want you to be an all-around rider. We don't want you to be too specific. Every aspect and every discipline of snowboarding can help you in every way. So riding half pipe and slope style gives you air awareness and control of how your body feels when you're in the air. And then GS and slalom, you're learning how to turn. So, you know, building up both of those skill sets really actually helped with border cross, because border cross is this combination of it all. So even though I started with border cross, my skills, I believe, were also developed and encouraged while I was pursuing these other disciplines as well.
And then I guess at what stage did this kind of hobby and family kind of trip and all the kind of fun side of it then become quite serious, and it was like, oh, actually, this is something I'm really good at? When did that happen?
That started after the fire still, because, you know, we got all of our snowboarding equipment, we were doing all of these races, and once I was starting to do well with these races, did Stratton Mountain School notice that I was a potential contender as this local kid to be in this world? You know, the first nationals I went to, it was just me and my dad. It wasn't anything organized at all. Like, looking back, we were so unprepared for that moment, but we didn't care because we were just going along with it. It was just snowboarding. We're going out to Colorado and having this incredible experience. The next year, I was on the Stratton Mountain School team and started to have the knowledge and the support of the school to be putting myself in better positions to start to do better on that snowboarding front, not just within my age group, but it was helping me because I was constantly training with people better and older than myself. And I think that was always an important thing, because that reflected back to me as a little kid chasing my brother, who's always bigger, who's always better. And so even though my brother was away at school doing his thing, being at Stratton, I then had new, you know, older, stronger, better snowboarders to follow in their footsteps.
At what stage did you then become like one of the best in the country? Obviously, you were competing at some of the tournaments like X Games and World Junior Championships. At what stage did all the kind of the national side of it kind of come into it?
Again, it was not something that was planned. You know, we do all of the nationals, and there was the Burton US Open that came to Stratton, and that was just an incredible event to be a spectator at. But I actually got the opportunity to be a forerunner at that event. I wasn't old enough to compete under FIS rules because I was 14 years old, but I got in the door to be a forerunner because I was a local kid. I trained on that hill, so they weren't concerned I was going to be injured. And that also that same year, I was old enough, don't ask me how, with FIS rules, maybe it fell more under freestyle at that time, but I was allowed to compete on the border cross side of things. And that finish at the border cross qualified me for my first X Games at Mount Snow, which again, I was pretty local, so they were kind of giving those wild cards and that opportunity for that experience to some of those local kids. So that was really, I would say, a defining moment that helped me get to that next tier of more prestigious events. And then that would kind of just compound following graduating high school, qualified to be on the World Cup tour and travel with Team USA.
And then I guess coming up to your kind of third defining moment, which is the Olympic announcement, because obviously at that point we only had slalom and halfpipe in the Olympics. And then in 2003, they announced border cross is going to be in Torino in 2006. And for you, that being I guess specializing in border cross at the time, I know you still did half pipe and slopestyle and stuff, but this must have been a big moment for you when you're like, okay, there is a path ahead of me now where I can reach this Olympic goal. And how did you deal with that?
my parents always felt I had this great competitive drive, and my mom always made the joke that I was either going to be in the Olympics or join the circus, because she just didn't really know how to, she didn't understand my unbridled energy and enthusiasm and wild side to me. But in 2002, the Olympics were in Salt Lake. I actually got to forerun in the half pipe. So that was kind of that first peek and look at that Olympic stage and what that really felt like to be in that moment, even though I wasn't competing. I got to see this opportunity, and we were the ones that were, you know, prepping the, you know, medical staff on how to deal with certain situations. So they would say, okay, you're a forerunner, you're going to do a trick, but you're going to fall, and they need practice to get you, or you're going to be, you know, this person that does this. And so it was pretty interesting, but it set that stage and that tone. I didn't know at that time that I would be, you know, considered to be in the half pipe, because I was still relatively new, but I was trying to up my game and push myself. But then that next year in 2003, I was graduating, and I was also showing more skill set in border cross. They announced that border cross would be in the Olympics, and my parents were like, oh my God, this is it. Like, this is what you were supposed to do. This was not planned from 5 years old, how some of the sports are, you're seeing that conditioning and that level, that age level, just be lower and lower and lower every time. This was just an opportunity that my parents put me in, and they're like, you like it. We, you know, Benny liked football, and he, you know, dabbled in other things, but it wasn't clear what my desire and drive would be ultimately until this moment. And that was a pretty unique experience. It's like, this is what I could go for, and started traveling with the U.S. team more consistently for border cross, as well for half pipe still. So it was still on the table that I was potentially going to try to make it for half pipe as well, but I was showing more promise in border cross.
Yeah, well, the 2003 X Games that year, you won the gold in the border cross and the bronze in the slopestyle. So like you say, it was already kind of happening at that point. And then I suppose, like, in the years between that and Torino, you kind of establish yourself as, you know, the world number one in this sport, and it's a new event that's going to be in the Olympics. And did you suddenly start to realize there was a little bit of a tension and pressure kind of almost on you?
I would say not until probably 2005 is when they start doing like the big media pushes and the stories behind you, and probably didn't start feeling some of the pressure until that moment. But like I said, I wasn't mentally conditioned as a very, very young kid that this would be my path. It was just something that I stumbled onto. So who knows if that played into any sort of mindset or preparation going into 2006.
Well, let's talk about 2005, where you are world champion, and then you are kind of going into this first Olympics, it's a brand new event. There's going to be a lot of eyes on it, and you are the world champion. Was there a bit of hype then from like Team USA? Was it, this is going to be our gold medal hope?
I would say definitely I got a lot of hype in that regard, but most of the pressure I put was directly on myself, because since I was winning, I loved winning, and winning became the only thing, you know, instead of taking the opportunity to learn that you can grow and learn something from not winning, because I just won so much early on, there wasn't an understanding that there could be another way to be excelling, if that makes sense. And I only learned that probably in the years after Torino, and the growth that I had to do, especially coming back from injuries, and you're not going to win right away, that you have to be taking those little steps and building those building blocks to get back to where you were. So it was interesting to start off and start having that success right off the bat, instead of that gradual build like a lot of athletes have. It was just weird timing circumstance and just how it came together. And who knows if that could ever be replicated again. And so many people ask, well, how'd you do it? What'd you do? And I'm like, there's no blueprint. There's no exact way to find out how you're going to have success. And trying to educate, you know, friends and family and other people that are trying to get into the sport, that's very important for them to know.
And then, as you mentioned, obviously with the event kind of being quite new, and you kind of grown up almost not expecting to be an Olympian.
Like, 100%.
How did you feel then when it was told you are an Olympian, you're going to go to the Olympics?
I guess my best understanding of it, what with the excitement behind it, was it didn't probably hit until opening ceremonies to have the realization that you're all dressed in the same outfit and you're walking out with Team USA. That's what makes that event feel bigger and different, because there's so much media around it, and I've never had that exposure on that level before. I did a lot of media preceding the Olympics and other events, but to have it of that magnitude was nothing I'd ever experienced before.
And then I guess this does bring us on to your fourth defining moment, which obviously is Torino, which I guess it's weird now, isn't it? Because I feel like if I'd asked you this question 2 years ago, it might have had a different answer. But because of Beijing, obviously, it's a little, we look at it a little differently, I suppose. But taking you back to that day and obviously that race, you know, you're in the final of the Olympics. You know, you've got a big lead, and obviously you're coming up to the final jump, and you want to add a little bit of pizzazz to this Olympic final. And obviously, it doesn't go to plan, and you end up with a silver medal. I mean, talk us through that race from your point of view, and how it went down, and how you kind of got yourself back up again at the end of that race.
I mean, those moments have played in my mind over and over and over again. And it wasn't until, you know, when I was writing this book, that I actually watched this race from start to finish for the first time. I could never really bring myself, because there was so much shame and there was so much just pain around that moment, because I did feel like I failed my country and I let so many people down, because I'd come back and random people would come up to me and be like, how could you do that? And I'm like, you know, for me, I was like, how am I making somebody so upset that wasn't even their moment? Like, they didn't mess up. I didn't personally affect them. It was so hard to comprehend why I had hurt that individual. That had nothing to do with snowboarding. That was really challenging. And at the end of the day, it was just a mistake. I was caught up in the moment. I was having so much fun. It was not something I planned for, being like, oh, if I'm ahead in the start gate, I'm totally going to do a move. It was just like, oh my gosh, I'm ahead and it's almost over. And all of this stress and everything, it's going to be over soon. And like, decided to do it right then and there, and didn't even prepare for it. Didn't think I was going to do that. That's not, you know, I broke that down so many times trying to understand that, and until really watching that footage, could I see that more in my body position. Learning over the years, I had to deal with injuries and other setbacks. And when you are down and out and you are not able to be doing what you're doing and going through the motions, and you're stuck on a PT table and not able to do what you love, you have no choice but to be looking inward and finding those that inner strength and those stepping stones to get back to the rider and competitor that you essentially were. It was this defining moment because the world had defined me in some way. Yeah. And it was how I defined myself and how cruel I became to myself, and that I had to get back to winning. Winning was the only way. I have to prove, you know, myself, and my self-worth became attached to how I was finishing. And, you know, that was potentially a driving force to keep me going. But I was just a diehard competitor, and I didn't want to just give up on myself. And at almost every Olympic cycle, you know, it was always such the big buildup, and they'd just say my story over and over again, no matter what Olympic cycle we would be in. And it was sometimes just crushing. It's, you know, and I was in the mix every time, and almost either got into finals, or there was just something that kind of kept me from winning. But it was just written in such a harsh, cruel way that I'd be like, maybe it's just time for me to be done with this sport. And I never wanted to decide to hang it up after an Olympics, because I'm like, well, I don't want to make a rash decision on something that I love after that moment. Maybe I'll do one other year, see how I feel. And then that was kind of always the cycle. And then I find the love again, because the year after the Olympics, it's not as stressful. You're trying new boards and new side cuts in it. And it brings the joy of the sport back again, because it's not this big build up and intense moment as every Olympic cycle year build up right before. So that's how I felt like it helped keep sustaining me to have that break. And then, you know, another Olympic cycle would come up and I'd have to go through that whole rigmarole again. I decided, you know, I'm not going to let this pressure or these comments affect and make me make a decision to stop, because I know I still have more to offer this sport. I'm constantly raising the bar in this sport for women, and I can say that I helped contribute to, you know, the sport and how women came up into this sport. And I'm happy to be a part of that. And even in those moments, looking back, that it's like, if I don't win, I still help get the sport where it is today. And that was probably the glimpse of those like little kind moments that I was starting to give myself. But it probably wasn't until 2016 is when I found my mental coach. And we had to do that hard, deep, you know, self-reflection and figure out how my emotional reactions were really dictating how I felt about myself, and then ultimately how I was, you know, going into my Olympic moments pre and post. Denise was with me right before Korea, and I got a fourth. So I made it to finals, and it was a photo finish. Like, it could have gone either way. And you sit there and you think, what could I have done more? What did I do wrong? And I basically came to that realization right there that it just wasn't my day. You know, I sat with coaches and we looked at video and we were trying to think, well, what if you did this? And we're like, no, because you would have been in a bad position for this. And just who ultimately knows? And a lot of the times with sports and in the Olympics especially, the stars have to align for you, and it's either going to be your day or it's not. And so that's when I started to first show myself that forgiveness and telling myself, you know, keep plugging away. You're still doing great. You still have, you know, the support of family and friends and the industry to keep increasing your level in the sport. And if it's going to be your day, you're going to be your day.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that 2006 moment was a weird one in a way, because I think had you won the gold, your name wouldn't be as big as it was, if that makes sense, at the time.
100%.
It's a strange thing, isn't it? It's like you almost did put the sport on the map back then, in a way, and you've grown it a lot. But then at the same time, the media reaction, and I guess lucky in a way that social media was in its infancy at the time, because it could have been a lot worse.
Yeah.
But I suppose you were only 20, and I think a lot of people forget that looking back.
Yes.
In today's eyes, you were still very young, and there was a lot of negativity, which would probably, you know, affect you in various different ways. How did you cope with the tabloids and the headlines and all that kind of stuff?
That was really challenging, because sometimes I couldn't avoid it, and it would put me into these moments that I would be upset or depressed, and then I would have friends and family help, you know, push me through. My mother would go through my mail, because I was getting still snail mail, just regular mail. That's how people would ask for autographs or anything. And some people would be saying that, you know, you still represented our country well. But then I did also get hate mail and pretty cruel things that were showing up at my door. And my mom would go through those and, you know, kind of weed those out. And if it was a good message, she would be like, you got to read this. She was helping filter out some of that negativity to help reinforce my mental state to see myself in a better way. But then as social media became a little bit more consistent and well-known as a form of communication, that wasn't an easy thing for my mom to really shelter me from. So every Olympic cycle, it would come about, and those messages would trickle in through, and you're just going through business as usual. And then you see something that's just like, you're the worst snowboarder. You're horrible. How could you? And you're like, oh my gosh, like, where did this come from? Why is this just coming through, happening now? It was definitely hard in those moments. And the only thing I could really do was just keep trying to push myself, keep winning, keep growing. And that cycle was working for a while until ultimately it wasn't, and had to look at the whole picture and be like, okay, so I am in the mix. I am in the conversation. I have the ability. Is something missing in my whole, just in the whole picture? And that's when I decided to be like, maybe I look at mental coaching, because I hadn't really done that. It was the only thing I hadn't. I've been preparing physically, you know, in the gym, on the snow for years and years after, and still getting to that moment, but there was something always holding me back or not coming together for me. So in 2016, that was probably, you know, the best decision I made. And my coach found Denise Shule of the Rethink Group. She came to the US team and said how her methods could help professional athletes. She's actually works with day traders on Wall Street, and how that mental stress and that emotion that goes into those trades and understanding of how the markets or what the market is going to be doing is very similar to how an athlete would be going through their sport, because there are emotions involved in our decisions and what we do. So she was correlating that with that this could be helpful. And my coach was like, I think I have an athlete for you. So that was huge that my coach recognized that this could be potentially a great fit for me. So Denise and I made some great strides in 2006, preparing for the 2018 Pyeongchang Olympics. And that was when I started to really get into a great stride and completely view my racing in a different way.
Yeah, well, this is your fifth defining moment, is that kind of 2016 kind of getting the mental side of things right. And I guess you mentioned before that the kind of the cycles of the Olympics and how it all worked, and how you'd go to the Olympics and like it didn't work out. Say 2010, you were disqualified, I think, is that right, in the semifinals? Did you miss a gate?
Yeah, in the start section, I just got a little off balance with the speed and the texture of the snow. It had been pouring that whole day, and we'd been on hold, and just to be all in your gear starting at 6 a.m. and then not start until like super late into the morning to get even things started. It made the day drag on, and that's just mentally draining to deal with. And as soon as we got into heats, I just got a little tangled and got off balance. So I was not able to finish that first bank turn, and just ended up DQing. And right then and there, I'm like, it's over. And I didn't even make it to finals. Like, this was upsetting. So then you're put into the consolation round right then and there. And you have to forget that previous round and know that now you're going from fifth to eighth place, but there are still spots to be awarded and you can't just give up.
Yeah. Well, and you did get the fifth place, and you did get the win on the small final. But I suppose because you, in between those years, you were still winning the X Games, you were still winning world titles, especially like that was the cycle, wasn't it? It was like the Olympics maybe wouldn't work out, and then you'd come back the next year and it'd be another world gold. So I suppose you can understand why because the media is mainly focused on the Olympics and they weren't maybe focusing on these other wins. So how did you manage to balance that when you have got a cabinet full of gold medals, but then all they care about is that one you haven't got?
Mainly my parents and my brother and all my friends would be like, you're being too hard on yourself. You have to find a way to move on, because you are still winning these events. You are someone that can have the potential to win. And it was just cruel, and it was really hard that the media put just so much emphasis on that. And you see that throughout a lot of different sports, that, you know, that person could be the favorite, or you have someone that, you know, just had their amazing moment in victory and knocked out the favorite before. I feel and I understand what those athletes all go through. And what was particularly challenging is, since my sport was so new, there weren't a lot of sports broadcasters or journalists that really had a great understanding of the sport, and they felt like they could commentate and put their own spin and their own opinion into my sport, which they knew nothing about, and they didn't pay attention in between those 4 years of what was happening. So I had to constantly be doing a lot of work on myself to keep telling myself I was worthy of that moment, which ultimately was draining mentally and fatiguing. So that also doesn't set myself up for that moment to potentially become a gold medalist at the Olympics when I'm having to do all of this like mental triage in the buildup of a major competition. So it was probably starting in 2018 when I started to show myself that forgiveness. And in those last 4 years building up to Beijing, which was a major turning point for myself. And my mental attitude going into Beijing was, I have the ability to win. It just might not happen. And I have to be okay with that because ultimately I've been to the Olympics 5 times. And right then and there is a huge accomplishment itself. And I had to keep telling myself over and over again. And I wasn't the favorite to win. And I had been just written off as this person that keeps blowing it in on this Olympic stage. And it's like, okay, anyone can tell themselves whatever they want about me as this person and that I've always messed up on this stage. But ultimately, I need to view myself differently. I need to tell myself that I'm worthy of this moment, and it's either going to happen for me and all come together, or it's not, and that's okay. But man, yeah, was that hard. That was hard to force myself to really take in.
Yeah, I was going to ask you kind of, yeah, about the kind of the build up to Beijing, because obviously, like, say each Olympics brings its own different challenges, and I know obviously before, like Sochi, for example, you had injuries and you missed a year, so it was kind of like a little bit undercooked maybe going into that one. And then I guess, as you mentioned, you just missed the medal in Pyeongchang. That was, again, that's just racing. It was one of those things where you're, what, 0.03 of a second off a medal. So it's kind of like, that's just board across, and that's kind of what happened. Whereas this one, it was like you were coming into Beijing and you weren't, so you didn't have world titles in between the Olympics. What did you? It was like, it was just, like you say, almost like people had not forgotten about you, but it was like, oh, she's still there, but she's not the dominant force in this event. Did that help you, I think, kind of going forward with Beijing?
So much stress wasn't really put on me in that way. I knew the narrative that would always be attached to my story, but I believe my last win was in 2019 in Feldberg, Germany. So that was like my last World Cup win, but I was getting podiums. And so I knew I was in the mix, and potentially if the course was really going to play into my skill sets, then I would have a chance. And when I got to Beijing, I saw this as this like X Games style course. And I was like, oh, I have the most experience on a course like this. It's long, it's got big features, it's got drafting, it's got technical features, it has everything. And that's the type of course I grew up on. That's what I would be training. So you had to have the strength of all of those skill sets. On tour, we see more shorter courses because it's expensive to build a border cross course and it needs a lot of snow, where sometimes we can't really know how much snow builders are going to have at a specific time, specific location. We can always say, oh, we're going to have a border cross competition on this weekend, but if there's not a lot of snow, they can be a little limited, and that's not their fault. That's just what Mother Nature is giving them. So a lot of times we could have border cross courses that are only 35 seconds long, and it's the start that's the most important thing. And as I've gotten older, starts have been a little harder to contend with those young 20-year-olds that have, you know, endless energy and can recover very easily from between each race. So I was excited, and I didn't get to do the test event in November that preceding year because I broke my arm. But everyone that was there was telling me, Linz, you're going to love this course. And I'm like, oh, I have a broken arm. Like, I can't think about this right now. I'm just not set up in this great position. But who knows, maybe breaking my arm made me put so much focus on getting better and getting this arm strong and not having a chance to think about the kind of buildup. I mean, again, you don't know why certain things happen, and that is always so hard to look back and be like, why? And then maybe later in your life, you'll be like, oh, well, all of these factors did help. But at the end of the day, it's like it either works out for you or it doesn't. And you have to be at peace with yourself before that moment comes to really give yourself that grace and that acceptance.
Yeah, and obviously you have touched upon your kind of like mental coaching and stuff going into these last two Olympics you had, especially the Beijing. I suppose, how did you approach it? As it your fifth Olympics, like, so you've been there, you've kind of done it, you kind of know what the drill is. But were you going into it thinking, this is my last chance? Or was it a case of, I'm just going to go and enjoy this and see what happens?
I vowed to myself that this Olympic cycle would be different. This would be an exciting experience. This would be a memorable experience. For God's sakes, Lindsay, you made it to five Olympics. Like, I had to tell myself that. And then I also decided, I sat down with my coaches and they said, like, what if you don't do the media beforehand? And I was like, am I allowed to do that? Like, of course, yeah. So I decided, no, I'm not doing media going into this. I'm not going to put myself in that situation. And, you know, we're told from when we're younger, like, you know, you should do all these things because it helps get your story out there. And I was like, my story's out there. If somebody doesn't know it already, then they've been on a different planet as far as, because it's always been just beat into the media every time. So I think giving myself that moment and putting myself first, I truly honored myself in that decision. And I think that was a big moment for me personally.
And then in terms of actually being in Beijing, you say you've seen the course, you think, okay, this kind of suits me. And then it's kind of like you go through the rounds pretty comfortably and then you find yourself on the start line of the final. What was going through your mind on that start line? And then can you just talk us through that race?
Getting into the finals felt like an Olympic win for myself because my semifinal heat was the most challenging heat I had experienced that whole day. I was against one of my young teammates that has one of the best starts, and she is a very strong rider. And then I was against Michaela, a former Olympic champion, and then I was also against Chloe. And Chloe has always been, you know, on the podium. She never really lets down her guard, and she is always riding very fierce. So making it on that, I told myself, I belong here. I belong in this final. I just did that. And then once we were lined up in the gate, I had just this calming feeling going over me because I'm like, wow, I have a 75% chance at a medal. I'm like, these are great odds. You can never get these odds. So I had that moment where I'm like, it could work out. And I'm like, but I'm in a great position now to walk away and have a totally different Olympic experience that I've ever had. And that was that moment. And then when I pulled out and I had like a great start, I'm like, oh my God, that actually just went up higher. I have an even better opportunity. So that was an incredible feeling. And then crossing that finish line and doing that big toe side turn was again me giving myself some space, because if you stop right down at the bottom, you know, the cameras swarm you, the media starts to swarm you. And I wanted that little hot lap. I wanted that like little decompression and to give myself space to take out my mouth guard, compose myself, but then ultimately absorb the moment, because that moment was mine, essentially. And I wanted it a little bit just privately to myself before I went down and grabbed the flag and everything. Like, I felt I deserved that.
And how did you feel? I know it sounds strange, obviously, the emotions of those 16 years, really, since that last moment. How did that feel, really, to you inside?
I was overwhelmed, and it probably didn't even sink in fully, I want to say, not until a few months later in May, because you have that moment, you have that, like, that experience, and you have that feeling like, I just won. But you're still very overrun with so many other factors that, you know, I have to prepare for my next race, but I'm sent through all this media and I have to do all of these other, you know, obligations first, and then have to do another race in a couple of days. And then were immediately having to round things up and fly out of there because of COVID protocols, like athletes couldn't just hang around. So there wasn't this like downtime that I was allowed to actually process what was happening. And then after that, we finished out the rest of our season. And so it wasn't until, you know, the official World Cup season had ended and that I flew home and got to spend time with family and friends, and I'm actually holding my medal and sharing my experiences, like, did it actually hit me? And I know that sounds so weird because you're like, how could that not hit you? But it took a while till I actually was able to slow down and really take it all in. It's very unique feeling.
Yeah, and obviously you must have been aware that this was going to be a big story back home, especially with, you know, like you say, the Olympic media cycle all the time. It was always, everyone knows my story, but now to get that fairy tale ending, you just knew that that was going to be a big deal, right?
Definitely, and I think it also gave me some relief going into the mixed team race, and I had this like different energy as well. And it probably wasn't until like we were in the start gate going and racing that I was like, oh my God, Bomb's gonna want a medal too. Like I need to bring it back. I need to focus and get back into this. You know, you don't want to lose pace and you don't want to drop the ball. You want to stay focused. And that's why I think that was another reason why I didn't have that moment where I got to really celebrate and work through that, because I'm still actively competing and you can't just completely turn it off and lose focus.
Yeah, I was going to ask about the mixed team event, because obviously that was a new one for Beijing. So I guess you had two medal chances going into these Olympics, which I guess helps a little bit. But the fact you already won that gold, riding on this confidence, but like you say, you had someone else that was banking on this medal as well. So that what was the pressure like on that run?
I mean, there was definitely pressure, but I didn't feel it until I was actually put into the start gate. You know, the night before, I slept just fine. And like, I'm still like on cloud nine, that I'm like, I'm in a good place mentally. But then when we got all of our stuff together and we're riding up on the chairlift together, the dynamic is a little different. And yes, you say that we have two chances to get a medal, but however, if you don't do well enough in the first race, you are not put into the team dynamic. So I couldn't even be thinking about this team race until the individual race was over and done with. And Baum had been paired with me because he had strong enough fist points from the overall year preceding, because he didn't do very well in his individual race and how upsetting that was for him. So this was his redemption moment. And I was like, well, isn't that nice that you didn't have to wait 16 years? So I'm like, I'm here for you. I can't let him down.
And then I guess on that race as well, when it did come to the last kicker, there was a little bit of a grab there, which I personally love that. Did you plan that?
No, again, I didn't plan that. And I started grabbing and I was like, oh, no. Like, let's finish things out. Because again, I just, you're lost. You can get lost in the moment so easily when you're having fun, and snowboarding still is so much fun. And I didn't tweak out the grab as much as I would have liked, because I'm like, okay, I just realized I did that. Like, let's focus in. We got to land and tuck to the finish. This was like a day. It was just nuking snow. There was all these little piles everywhere. I'm like, I can't be messing around with this. But I felt on top of the world in that moment. And to be able to give Nick his Olympic moment, I was really happy that I could support him in that way.
And it was a great race. You really had to kind of come from behind in that last one. It was just down to the two of you, wasn't it? It was pretty close.
Yes. And knowing that with my years of experience with that kind of snow, amount of snow, the wind, visibility, it almost bode in my favor that I was not leading. So I wasn't pulling, you know, the women behind me in the draft, that I could stay close, maintain my speed. It's sometimes easier when you have somebody in front of you when the visibility is not that great to see texture and see what's happening with their board. So you are now prepared to feel that as well. Because you think, you know, you train the course, how do you not know it's coming? There's so many little variables that can be on the course that you can't see. And yes, they put the dye on, but when you are traveling that fast, your brain can only process textures and see things fast enough for then you to react. But I knew Michaela being goofy, I knew if I set myself up on the right side of her coming out of turn three and I stayed to the right, then she wouldn't be able to block me and I could be a little bit tighter in that second to last turn. So you are processing and thinking about things down the way on the course, but you are also having to be active and be focused in the moment. So it is a skill set that takes years to develop, and it's still, you know, a sport that you could be learning things about your riding and your skill set for years to come. And that's why you can see older athletes in this sport and you have more longevity.
Well, yeah, you mentioned that obviously the fact that Nick's 4 years older than you. It's like a 40-year-old and a 36-year-old winning the first ever team event. That must have been a little bit satisfying, wasn't it?
Yes, it was a nice cherry on top, because Nick and I definitely struggle a lot of the time to keep up with the younger athletes. You know, if you're trying to push yourself and you fall or you have an injury, it takes that much longer to come back, or just your day-to-day training has to be different that of a 20-year-old. You can't beat yourself up the same way. You have to be more executed and you can't do the grind, as to say, as you would be grinding as a young kid. So it's everything. It's how you're training in the gym, it's how you're training on snow, and how you're mentally training when you know you don't have certain things in your favor during that time. So to have Nick and I win and be the more seasoned athletes, it was a great feeling that these younger kids haven't pushed us out of the sport yet.
And then a lot of people would have thought, oh, she's going to retire then. She's got that Olympic gold. The story's finished, you know. It's gone full circle moment with that little grab in the mix. So, but then this year, you're winning, you're the oldest ever medalist at the World Championships now with the bronze that you got this year. So what motivated you to carry on?
The first question after I was like, oh my gosh, you just won, and you just won the team race. Like, are you going to go for another Olympics? You're like, oh my gosh, can I just be in this wow. moment? That's a hands down stock question that you get from the media every time. And again, I didn't want to be quitting just after the Olympics. I thought that would be such a weird way to pull the plug and take myself out of the sport when I just proved that to the world that I still have the desire and the ability to win. So I told myself, I'll do another year. I'll do another World Cup season and reassess and see how I feel. And then I had started writing the book. So it was very hard to kind of put a lot of that time into writing the book and to be doing my training and to be traveling and competing. So I definitely felt I was a little distracted throughout last year. I don't know what my retirement plan looks like or how my transition out of sport looks like. It's very hard to stop something that you have given 20 plus years to, and how it could just be like, should I just pick a day and cut off and be done with it? Or is it a race by race scenario? I still can't answer that myself. So right now I'm working on other possibilities of different career options that I am showing interest in. And that's personal training. That's a event production. That's a event announcing. I've done some stuff with surfing as well as snowboarding as well. Trying a bunch of things to see what I'm going to have that passion, because I don't know how to find that passion in that next venture that I've given so much time and years with snowboarding. So right now, still navigating that path, and I don't know what that exactly looks like.
But are you planning to compete next season?
I am still actively competing. I was training this summer as if I was competing. Now we're just waiting on snow. So I'm still doing this book tour and seeing what opportunities can come from this moment, and wanting to share my story, I think, was more important, even though there are those challenging moments of reflecting back to Torino. But I thought it was important that people understood my experience, my perspective of my Olympic journey, just so they can understand themselves and give themselves a better route to success and not give up on themselves, but also a little education on what athletes potentially can go through.
And I suppose if you were to kind of go back and speak to that 20-year-old Lindsay who just had that moment in Torino, what would you say to her?
I would say that certain moments might define you and carry on this image of yourself, but ultimately you still have that control to, you know, define yourself and put yourself in the light that you deserve.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess over the years you've learned you did do that, and you've obviously got that kind of, do you feel like it's a fairy tale ending, Beijing, or do you feel like that's just what the media have told you?
I mean, it wasn't this fairy tale lined up. Like there was so much work that went into it. It wasn't that, oh, I was finally, you know, gifted and given the Olympic moment that I deserved. It was, I would say that the stars aligned and the opportunity presented itself, and that I was in the right physical and mental space to execute and make it happen. And so from a media standpoint, it does seem like this fairy tale, but the media doesn't stick with you every 4 years in those growth, in those big moments in between.
And I guess, obviously, we've mentioned, like, it's been 20 years since they announced it was going to be in the Olympics, and obviously you're snowboarding professionally a long time before that. What is it that keeps you going? And just tell us about your actual passion for being on the board.
I mean, sometimes the training for border cross is grueling, it's tedious, it can beat you up, but when I pull out of the gate, when I'm racing in the moment and I'm chasing down the person, because I'm usually not winning the start, it brings me back to those childhood memories of chasing my brother down, chasing my dad or Bob or Mark. And it ultimately is this definition of who I truly am as an athlete, as a competitor, and my just inner spirit, which is why I think it's held this special place in my heart.
Okay, I'm just going to ask you, just recapping your five defining moments. That was the first one was the first turns on a snowboard. The second one was that house fire that kind of changed the trajectory of your career a little bit. The third one was the Olympic announcement that it was going to be, snowboard cross was going to be in the Olympics. The fourth one was obviously Torino. And then the fifth one was your linking up with your performance coach to kind of get you through those last few years. And if you had to pick one of those, which you feel is your ultimate defining moment, do you know which one that would be?
Oh, gosh. I would think it would be 2016, because the past is in the past and you have to learn how to deal with what you've done throughout your career and your life and figure out how to turn it to your advantage. And for a long time, I was just very hard on myself and cruel, and I really had to grow as an individual, not just as an athlete. And I definitely couldn't have done it without Denise. And I was truly happy with making those strides and those connections to the emotional response with snowboarding and with those Olympic moments to help really get me in that time frame. So as far as all of my moments, all those moments are key moments that helped me get on my path to what I was going to do in life. But I would say my defining moment with Denise determines who I became and who I really am as a person. And that did not happen till, you know, my mid-30s.
Yeah, I guess that's it. I guess it is just, sometimes it is experience that has taken you to get to that point and to kind of ask for that kind of help. But I suppose all of this can be read in your book,
yes.
Which is out now, as we said.
Yes.
It's called Unforgiving, Lessons from the Fall, which is obviously quite an appropriate title. And it's available to buy everywhere, and there's an audio version is there as well.
Yes. It was really fun to be a part of this process and have the support of HarperCollins. And, you know, this has been over a year and a half in the making and editing and figuring out my message and how I wanted to inspire people and give them that hope.
Cool. Well, I definitely look forward to reading it. And thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I hope you enjoyed it.
Yes, I did. Thank you so much for having me. And hopefully I'll be in Europe in a month or so. Hopefully there's snow.
Fingers crossed.
Yes.
Well, what an inspirational chat there with Lindsay. It just proves that persistence pays off. The digital and audio versions of Lindsay's book, Unforgiving, are available now. However, the hard copy is only available in the UK from the 23rd of November. Thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast, and I will be back soon with more My Defining Moments.